Just one more chapter in this unit before you're able to enjoy the next exam, which is exactly 2 days from now. This final chapter in the unit is about lipids, which are one of the four classes of biological macromolecules, right? At least according to some, not everyone actually qualifies lipids as macromolecules because they're not nearly as big as the other three officially big macromolecules. What else is different, though? Even if you do consider lipids to be macromolecules, what is different about them compared to the other three macromolecule classes? Right, they are not polymers. They're put together a little bit differently. They're not made of a bunch of monomers that are very similar to each other, stuck together in some way, like the polymers are. Lipids are, as you would expect, essential. I mean, you can't live without any individual one of the four classes of macromolecules. But what is it that makes a lipid? Well, really, lipids are kind of diverse. What is common among all lipids, what really classifies them as lipids, is that they are insoluble in water, at least to a large degree, whereas they are soluble in organic solvents. But water, no. And of course, that has important biological ramifications. This is why lipids are very important components of membranes, right? This is how life got started, by separating a little piece of the ocean from the rest of the ocean in that first cell, right? You have to have a membrane to make the little test tube in which life occurs. It has to be in its own little chamber, and membranes are able to do that, and lipids are important membrane components, but that's not the only thing they're important for. They're also very important for storage of energy. They're important fuels. They're not the only fuels, of course, but they are the predominant stored fuel. And why does that make sense? Well, the master fuel is what, regardless of what kind of cell you're talking about? Glucose, which is not a lipid, right? Glucose is a carbohydrate. And it provides good energy, just like other nutrient classes do. But we don't store much extra energy in the form of carbohydrate. When we do, those are the storage polysaccharides I've talked about, right? If a plant does it, it's starch. If an animal does it, it's glycogen. Bacteria also make glycogen. So there is a certain amount of energy stored in the form of polysaccharides, but not very much. Beyond that limit, the energy is stored in the form of lipids, regardless of whether it was taken in as a nutrient in the form of lipid or not. You know, you read candy labels, and they will use as a selling point zero fat, right? Because it's basically nothing but sugar. But when you know that doesn't mean it's not going to be turned into fat in your body. It gets turned into fat, a lipid, because that's much more efficient storage. Why is it much more efficient to store energy in the form of fat than it is to store it in the form of polysaccharide? Couple major reasons. One is that it has a higher energy density. Lipids, well, and when I'm talking about lipids, I mean storage of energy. I'm talking about one major kind of lipids, which are fats, which we'll talk more about. But the fatty acids that are in fats are more reduced than carbohydrates are. And therefore, when they get oxidized, more energy is released. And we'll talk more about this when we get into the metabolism chapters. But what I'm saying by this is that fat is said to have a much higher energy density than carbohydrate, because if you burn or oxidize a gram of each, you're going to yield more energy by burning that gram of fat than you are by burning that gram of carbohydrate. And therefore, if you're storing energy, if you have a certain amount of energy to store, you'll store it in less mass of fat than you would in carbohydrate. So if we stored all of our extra energy as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more than we do, because fat contains more energy in it per gram than carbohydrate does. But that's only part of it. That would be true. I mean, that's true regardless. But what also helps out is that when you make a fat, the fact that that fat molecule is hydrophobic means it's not going to interact with water, right? And therefore, it's stored in an anhydrous form, which is involved. There's not a bunch of water molecules that get put into the mix, which would take up extra space. So it makes it, it's not only more energy dense, but it's able to be more compactly stored within a cell. So they're important for, I mean, lipids are important for energy storage. But all that's not the only good thing about fat in your body, for instance. What else is important about fat? Right. Fat makes for good thermal insulation. So it keeps your body either warmer than the environment or cooler than the environment, depending on what's happening in the environment. It minimizes a change in body temperature. And also, it's important for cushioning, which is why it's deposited in certain parts of the body, preferentially. That cushioning protects deeper structures that would be damaged by day-to-day living. And that seems like a minor thing compared to the biochemical reasons, but it's an important function of lipids. Anyway, we'll talk about metabolism of lipids in other chapters when we talk about metabolic pathways, but this chapter is really about going through the major categories of lipids. And so there are about five major categories of lipids we'll talk about in this chapter, one of which is fatty acids, which are the fuels that are used directly when lipids are burned for the purpose of energy. It's fatty acids that get oxidized. So that's one category. The next category, though, is the storage form of those fatty acids, which is fats. Now, that's one word for it. You can call it a fat. That's the easiest one to spell and to pronounce. You can call a fat by either of two interchangeable names. What are the other names for a fat? Triacylglycerol is one, right? What's the other one? Triacylglycerol is really descriptive, and it's the one that biochemists usually use if they don't feel like saying fat. One that biologists use instead of triacylglycerol often is what? Very similar word. Triglyceride. So a fat, a triglyceride, and a triacylglycerol all refer to the same thing. It's the storage form of these fatty acids, and we'll look at its structure in a minute. But that's a second category of lipids. Third category is phospholipids, which we've already talked about, and I'm sure you've learned about a lot in other courses. You can't really overstate the importance of phospholipids because that's how life got started, right? The amphipathic nature of phospholipids allows for the lipid bilayer to form, meaning that the first plasma membrane is formed, which means the first cell comes into existence. There are also glycolipids. In the proteins chapter, we talked about glycoproteins, right? Well, there are also glycolipids, simply meaning a sugar attached to a lipid. And just like glycoproteins are important components of membranes, with that sugar component facing outward as an identifier, glycolipids serve the same function. They're important membrane components, and they're always found with the sugar component facing the exterior of the cell. The lipid component, of course, anchors it in the membrane itself, because the lipid component of a glycolipid has no problem being right beside the lipid tails of a phospholipid, right? The fatty acid tails. And then the final category are steroids, which are important for several reasons. They also are important membrane components. They're important for adjusting the fluidity of a plasma membrane in whatever kind of organism we're talking about. But they are also precursors for other kinds of molecules. For instance, all of your steroid hormones are examples of steroids, obviously. Vitamin D comes from the same stuff that your steroid hormones come from, which is cholesterol in you. So that's an important class as well. But we'll look at examples of these as we go through the slideshow. In this first slide, we're looking at just a couple fatty acids. And when you look at this shorthand notation for the structure, remember that every corner, if it's not labeled otherwise, every corner is a carbon, and then you just have to fill in hydrogens based on your knowledge of the valence of carbon, right? So every one of these corners on the top is a single carbon. Where are the hydrogens? How many? Well, there are two on every carbon that's not at the very end. There are three on the end, right? It's a methyl group at the end. But yeah, every one of these carbons that are interior, other than the two that are connected to oxygen at the end, have two hydrogens connected to them. In other words, all but the very end, one end, of a fatty acid is a hydrocarbon chain, right? That's what fatty acids are, really. A fatty acid is just a hydrocarbon chain of some type and some length that terminates at one end in what functional group? A carboxyl group, right. Now, this is a carboxyl that has ionized, which is, as we've already discussed, typical at physiological pHs, right? So you could see this as a C double bond O, COH, like a standard carboxyl group. But in most of your cells, that carboxyl is deprotonated so that there is this resonance structure that you see here. But that's really what defines a fatty acid. Hydrocarbon tail with a carboxyl at the end. And the only reason there are different types of fatty acids, which there are, is because of a couple variables. You can vary the number of carbons in the skeleton, so have different lengths of the hydrocarbon. There's nothing saying it has to end there, right? You can keep adding carbons and the required number of hydrogens for as long as you want. So in a laboratory, you could make this as long as you want. In living systems, they're usually around 18 or 20 carbons long. There are some others as well, but that's the average. But anyway, that's one reason why there are different kinds of fatty acids. Another reason is that there may or may not be double bonds between adjacent carbons. And so what are the words we refer to distinguish, I mean, we use to distinguish fatty acids that don't have double bonds compared to fatty acids that do? Saturated and unsaturated. And what does saturated mean in this context? It means that there are only single bonds. And the reason saturated makes sense as a word is because saturated means full, right? Well, in this sense, it means the fatty acid is full of hydrogens. The only way that hydrocarbon tail, which is most of the fatty acid, can hold the maximum number of hydrogens, given that each carbon forms four bonds, is for carbon not to double up on any bonds between two carbons. And therefore, there are two hydrogens at every one of these interior spots and then three at the end. That's the maximum number of hydrogens, so the fatty acid is saturated with hydrogens. That's why we use that word. As soon as you make one double bond in the interior of the hydrocarbon chain somewhere, like you do in oleate here on the bottom, you are creating two bonds between these two carbons. Therefore, this carbon is already making three bonds just with other carbons, right? Two with this carbon and one with this carbon. And therefore, it can only hold one hydrogen. In other words, you have to lose a hydrogen in order to do that, to form a double bond. So any fatty acid that has one or more double bond between carbons, and we're not talking about the double bond with the oxygen in the carboxyl, in the hydrocarbon part of it, if there is one double bond or more, then we call that an unsaturated fatty acid. When these things are, when fatty acids are incorporated into their storage form, fats or triacyl glycerols, whether or not those fatty acids are saturated is going to determine whether the fat as a whole is saturated or unsaturated. So we can use those words to refer to individual fatty acids, saturated and unsaturated, or as fats. An unsaturated fat is one in which all of the fatty acids that are part of that fat are themselves unsaturated. Okay? Now, the unsaturated status or saturated status of a fatty acid has important biological implications with respect to the use of fatty acids as components of still another class, which I've already talked about, which are the phospholipids. Phospholipids, just like fats, have fatty acids as part of their structure. Not as many, but they have fatty acids, right? There are two fatty acid tails in a phospholipid. Well, those fatty acids can be saturated or unsaturated, and then that is going to determine how well they pack together, because of the fact that when you form a double bond in a fatty acid of a living system, it's going to make a kink in this otherwise pretty straight hydrocarbon chain. Yeah, it's a zigzag, but it's overall straight. Well, when you put a double bond in there, you form a bend in it. Now, there are two possibilities, but in living systems, the bent configuration is the one that's always happens, and that's for good reason. That kink is going to make the overall fat or phospholipid, whichever it's part of, either more or less fluid. Well, if the kink will make it less fluid, right? Anyway, these are just typical fatty acids. So, I didn't finish the paragraph I started. what seems like a long time ago. I said that fatty acids can differ in their number of carbons. They can also differ in whether or not they're saturated, but also there is degrees of saturation. So this example, oleate, that has just one double bond. Well, you could have more than one double bond. And so you could have, notice that these two have the same number of carbons. If you count up the carbons, it's the same in these. You can have other versions, other fatty acids with their own names, with exactly the same number of carbons. But they would differ from both of these because they would have even more double bonds. All right, well, slide two just shows you why we call things the way we do. These are exactly the same compound, but when the carboxyl is in its ionized form, which it is, like I said, at physiological pH, then we call the fatty acid with a name that doesn't have acid in its name. It has the ate ending. So it's palmitate versus palmitic acid. Palmitic acid is the non-ionized carboxyl, but when it's ionized, we call it palmitate. That's just a nomenclature thing. They're really the same thing, though. Now, this methylene group that's shown in slide 3 is just to show you what a methylene group is. We call this a methylene group. The two lines represent residues, right? In the case of a fatty acid, that's just one long hydrocarbon chain, right? These are the two hydrogens that we were just talking about in slide 1 that you are imagining in each one of those carbons that are at a corner on it. So a saturated fatty acid has a bunch of methylenes, right? And then a methyl at the end, because there's not another carbon to connect to. So CH3 at the end, but CH2 is all the way down the line until you get to the carboxyl. If you have an unsaturated fatty acid, though, if you have a polyunsaturated fatty acid, which means one that has at least two double bonds, then you'll always see that the double bonds are spaced apart with at least one methylene group between them. So in other words, you don't see double bonds right next to each other, which would be possible, right? Chemically possible. You wouldn't have any hydrogens there on that one carbon in the middle. But that doesn't happen in biological fatty acids. There's always going to be a single bond between double bonds, and therefore there's going to be a methylene group in there somewhere, like you see in slide 4. Methylene group between double bonds. But the main idea of slide 4 really is not about that. Rather, it's about different ways in which we can number these carbons that are part of the hydrocarbon portion of a fatty acid. So in this case, notice that the carboxyl is on the left side. So it's switched compared to how we looked at them before. But we name that carbon that's part of the carboxyl the alpha carbon and start the numbering there. That's one way we can do it. So the blue numbers indicate that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way down. In this case, it has 18 carbons total. But whatever the number is, depends on the actual fatty acid. It's also, though, possible to count them from the other end. Well, alpha is the first carbon when you count from the carboxyl, and alpha is the first Greek letter. The final Greek letter is omega. So even though omega is not the 18th letter, it's the last letter in the alphabet. So however long this hydrocarbon chain is, it's not necessarily 18, we call that last one the omega carbon, just to represent the end of the alphabet. And we can therefore start counting backwards from the omega carbon, whatever number that happens to be. Omega is a different number, in other words, depending on the fatty acid length. But This is why we have names that you see popping up in nutrition all the time or in commercials. The importance of omega-3 fatty acids. That simply means that there is a double bond at the third carbon from the omega end. So omega-3 refers to this bond right here. A double bond between that third and fourth carbon from the omega end. And those are important because there's research that indicates that it's good for your heart for whatever reason is still not really clear. But they're important just because they're essential fatty acids. We can't produce them ourselves. We have to get them from the diet, whether from animals or plants. Anyway, that's just nomenclature. If we look at the table on slide 5, these are just a few of the possible fatty acids. And notice what's different about them. Well, the first several have zero double bonds, so all the ones with the zero in the row are saturated fatty acids. And if you look at their formulae, this is another way of shorthand describing them. You have the methyl at the end, then you have a certain number of methylenes, right, corresponding to the edges the corners on the zigzag. So 10 methylenes in this one, and then the carboxyl. That's just a way of representing, in pretty compact form, any given saturated fatty acid. But then the saturated ones have to have a double bond in them somewhere, so you see depictions of how many methylenes there are before you get to that double bond, and then how many methylenes after before you get to the carboxylene. So hopefully those formulae make sense to you. But they also, in addition to common names, which are still being used, which they've been around so long that people just don't want to give them up, there's also systematic names. And you have things like for oleate, which we looked at before. Remember, it had 18 carbons. Well, its systematic name is cis-delta-9-octadecaenoate. Now, octadeca means 18, right? 8 and 10. The cis refers to the fact that anytime you have a double bond, which doesn't swivel, right, there are two possible isomers, trans and cis. And I said earlier, even though I didn't use cis and trans lingo, that it's the bent configuration that's always favored in biological fatty acids, ones that are actually made by cells. What we call that bent configuration is the cis configuration, because cis means they're on the same side, right? The two hydrogens are on the same side. They're not across from each other, which is a trans configuration. So a trans doesn't form a bend, but a cis does. And that's what you'll find in natural fatty acids. But the delta notation here, delta is just a Greek D, so it's just a letter that stands for double bond, and it shows you where you find the double bond based on what the superscript on that delta is. So you have a cis configuration double bond at carbon number 9 in this particular fatty acid. It's called octadeca, meaning 18 carbons, but then you have ene as part of this name. Ene versus ane. What's the difference between ene and ane in organic chemistry? Right. We're talking about hydrocarbons, basically, the nomenclature of hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons that have no double bonds or triple bonds are called alkanes, right? And they end in the name. I mean, their names end in ane. If there's at least one double bond, then they're alkenes. Triple bonds are alkynes, right? So that's why you have either ene or an in the name before the O8. Now, the O8 ending is just the name we use if we're talking about the ionized form. So all of these words would also have a corresponding name, like N-octadecanoate. That would be N-octadecanoic acid if it has that hydrogen on it still. So I just want to make sense of all these words. I don't want you to memorize them all, of course, but they should just make sense to you based on all the information in the table. And we can see some examples in slide 6. The examples really aren't important here. It's just that it shows you a picture of what I've already told you about trans and cis forms. Trans fatty acids don't have a bend because of their trans configuration. There's no steric hindrance to bend them, basically. But we don't see that naturally, which is why this is usually something that nutritionists will be complaining about in the news, right? Trans fats are things you're supposed to be avoiding. Trans fats are artificially produced when unsaturated fats are partially hydrogenated artificially. Adding those hydrogens, this is how, for instance, vegetable shortening is made. Vegetable fatty acids, plant-based fatty acids, are usually not solid at room temperature like animal-based fatty acids are, because plant-based fatty acids tend to be unsaturated. They therefore have a bunch of bends in them. And when you have a bunch of bends in your fatty acids, several different fatty acids, each of which is bent, don't pack together very tightly. They're not as dense like a solid is, so at any given temperature, they're more fluid, they're more liquid. That's why plant-based fatty acids are oils rather than more solid things like lard. But sometimes you want to have it solidified for industrial purposes, food industry purposes. So you hydrogenate unsaturated fatty acids to make them more solid, like to make Crisco, for instance, and that makes trans fats in the process, which you wouldn't get from eating the organisms that produce these things naturally. Okay, and then in slide 7, just more examples of fatty acids. These things actually aren't bent like they are shown here. This is just so that they could all fit them on a page in the book. But you could unbend this to imagine the whole thing. What these things differ in, the only thing that these things differ in, I think they all have the same number of carbons, is just their degree of saturation. Or I should say their degree of unsaturation. There's only 3 double bonds in the top one, 5 and 6 in the bottom two. So this also is reflected in their name, by the way. Icosa, for the middle example. Icosa is a prefix that means what? What is an icosahedron to you D&D nerds? It's the 20-sided die, right? Icosa means 20. So icosa pentaene refers to, penta means 5, right? The icosa means 20 carbons. Penta means there are 5 double bonds. So since the ene refers to the double bond, pentaene means that there's going to be 5 double bonds in this thing, not just one. Whereas the bottom one is a hexaene, 6 double bonds. Okay. That's fatty acids. Let's go on to fats now, or triacylglycerols or triglycerides. The best of those terms in my book is triacylglycerol, because it really describes what you're looking at. There's also the complication that some people call fatty acids fats. I like to use the word fat to mean triacylglycerol, but if you use the word triacylglycerol, you know you're not talking about a fatty acid. You're talking about more than a fatty acid, right? It's just descriptive, though, of how these things are built. A triacylglycerol is called that because the molecule that holds the thing together, the molecule in its own right before it just becomes incorporated into the triacylglycerol, is a glycerol molecule. Glycerol, as the name implies, is an alcohol, right? Alcohols end in OL. Well, many of their names do. Glycerol is a 3-carbon triple alcohol. So glycerol by itself has 3 OHs, so it's triply an alcohol. It's the pink part of this overall triacylglycerol, but if it were on its own, each one of these pink O's would actually be an OH. Okay? So each one of those OHs makes it an alcohol. That's the thing that holds it together, because each of those OHs is a potential connection point if you use what kind of reaction to hook fatty acids to it. Hydrolysis doesn't link things together, it splits them apart. So you could hydrolyze this thing, but to build it, you would use, what did you say?
Condensation
or dehydration, same thing. Right? In a condensation reaction, something loses an H, something else loses an OH, which is why out pops water. Well, when you perform a condensation reaction between an alcohol and a carboxylic acid, what you form is an acyl, A-C-Y-L. What are carboxylic acids? Simply things that have a carboxyl in them, right? So fatty acids are called acids because they have a carboxyl group in them and therefore are operating as carboxylic acids. Well, that carboxyl end, when it's by itself, has a C double bond. The carboxyl itself is C double bond, and then also on that C is the OH, right? That OH gets lost in the process. The OH gets taken off of the carboxyl, and H gets taken off of the hydroxyl of the alcohol. That's your water that comes out, and then that sews the two things together. The alcohol and the carboxylic acid get sewn together in what we call an acyl group, which is why these things are no longer fatty acids, really, even though people say that a triacylglycerol contains three fatty acids. I even say that sometimes, it's just easier. Strictly speaking, what a fat or a triacylglycerol contains are three fatty acyls, because it's no longer a complete fatty acid now that it's lost that hydroxyl in the process of forming this bond with glycerol. But the reason I'm pointing this out word-wise is because that explains why this overall thing is called a triacyl glycerol. It's a glycerol connected to three fatty acyls. Okay? And that formation of that acyl group, that bond between the fatty acyl and the glycerol, is an example of an ester linkage. So each one of these linkages between the blue and the pink part is an ester linkage, which is why still another name for a fat, besides triacylglycerol and triglyceride, is an esterified fatty acid, because they're esterified to a glycerol molecule. Okay? Now, when this thing, fats are really storage of energy, like I said. When you break this thing apart, what you yield are three fatty acids and a glycerol. Well, you can actually do it one at a time. You can take off one fatty acid, you have what is called a free fatty acid, and the rest would be called a diacyl glycerol. But then you could dismantle it further into another fatty acid and a monoacyl glycerol. Finally, you have three fatty acids on their own and a glycerol, both of which are valuable fuels. Glycerol can feed into the metabolic pathway that we'll talk about later, and fatty acids can as well, into different parts, but they can both be oxidized as fuel. So it's a valuable molecule in terms of energy. Well, that's why if you have extra energy on hand and you've already maximized your glycogen stores, which are mostly in your liver and your skeletal muscles, then the rest of the extra energy gets transformed into triacylglycerols, and there are cells in your body that specialize in holding as many triacylglycerol molecules as possible. Those are called adipocytes, or adipose cells. Adipose is fat tissue, tissue that's made up of a bunch of adipocytes that are specialized for holding a bunch of these triacylglycerols as a huge lipid droplet that takes up most of the volume of the cell itself, as you see in this micrograph. All the organelles are basically pushed to the side. This thing is specialized for holding a huge amount of fat, just like a red blood cell is specialized for holding as much hemoglobin as possible. Really not much left in the cell. All right, so that's two of the categories. Now on 10, we're looking at the a schematic representation of the third category, which are phospholipids. And I want you to notice the similarity between a triacylglycerol and a phospholipid. They both include a glycerol molecule. Well, at least I should correct myself before I go on here. This schematic is a representation of one kind, or major kind, of phospholipid. There are two major subcategories of phospholipids, one of which are phosphoglycerides, and that's what we're looking at right here. Another one, though, is called a sphingolipid. So there are phosphoglycerides, and sphingolipids. Each of which is an example of a phospholipid. Now, a phospholipid, of course, gets its name because there is a phosphate group in it. Phosphoglycerides get their name for the fact that there's a glycerol in it. Sphingolipids get their name because there's a sphingosine in it, as we'll see in another slide. But this is the basic architecture of a phosphoglyceride. Just like in a triacylglycerol, glycerol is the thing holding the whole molecule together. It's the keystone of the whole thing, basically. And also, just like in a triacylglycerol, there are fatty acyl groups attached to by ester bonds to that glycerol. It's only two of them, though, in this case. There are three connection points in glycerol. Well, that third connection point phosphoglyceride is not made to another fatty acid. Instead, it's made to a phosphate group that's attached to some sort of alcohol, and there's different kinds of alcohols that could take this place. But a phosphate group connected to an alcohol takes up what would be taken up in a fat by a third fatty acid. And that makes a huge difference, because a triacylglycerol, which are still another name for them, is a neutral fat, is hydrophobic. Which is why they store so well without having a bunch of water involved, like I said before. Well, that's good for a fat. But a phospholipid is not completely hydrophobic, right? What word do we use to describe a phospholipid? Amphipathic, correct. Or amphiphilic. But amphipathic simply means that there's a dual nature to this overall molecule. It is partially polar and partially nonpolar, therefore partially hydrophobic, partially hydrophilic. That is why life exists, right? Because that amphipathic nature of phospholipids is what allows them to be ideally suited for forming just without any life, before there is actually life, just based on hydrophobic interactions, form the lipid bilayer that makes the first membrane of a cell. Okay, so that's a basic backbone of a phosphoglyceride. And we see in slide 11, in black, the glycerol itself. The two green things represent some fatty acyls, right? R1 and R2 just refer to the hydrocarbon chains, whatever they are, of those two fatty acyls. So those could be of whatever chain length, and they could be either saturated or unsaturated, or polyunsaturated. But then that third connection point on the glycerol is connected to phosphate immediately. And if all you have is just that phosphate, no alcohol yet, then we call that stuff phosphatidate, which does exist to a certain degree in your membranes. But most of your phospholipids, in addition to this general structure of phosphatidate, have something else connected to the phosphate itself, some alcohol, like I said. In which case, we don't call those things phosphatidate anymore, but we use that phosphatidate name in their overall name. Oh, before I leave that one, notice that the other name for phosphatidate is diacylglycerol-3-phosphate. Makes perfect sense, right? It's a diacyl, two fatty acyls, glycerol, with a phosphate on the third carbon, diacylglycerol 3-phosphate. But anyway, that is the basically the backbone for all the different kinds of phosphoglycerides. There's not just one kind of phosphoglyceride. They differ not only in the kinds of fatty acyls, but also in what the alcohol is that's connected to the phosphate. So you have words like phosphatidylserine, if it's serine that is connected to the phosphate, or phosphatidylcholine, which is a major constituent of your membranes, probably most in terms of the number of individual phospholipids in your membranes are phosphatidylcholine. But they all are phosphatidate with something connected to that phosphate. So that's why we use the word phosphatidyl when it's no longer a molecule by itself. It's that same architecture connected to something else. We use that YL ending. Okay. Slide 13. Sphingosine at the top. Now, sphingosine is just a component of a sphingolipid, but it's the reason we call it a sphingolipid. Sphingolipids have sphingosine in them. Sphingosine, notice, is an aminated fatty acyl. Notice the nitrogen up there. And it's that nitrogen that is a connection point between sphingosine in blue on the bottom and a fatty acyl in green, however long it is. But notice that sphingosine already by itself, unlike glycerol, sphingosine already has a hydrocarbon tail as part of it, which is why you only have to add one more hydrocarbon tail in the form of a fatty acyl in order for this thing to have two fatty acyl tails, right? See what I'm saying there? And then the phosphate group is hooked to one end of the sphingosine, and then you can hook some sort of alcohol to that or other component. Sphingomyelin is a specific kind of sphingolipid. There are different kinds of sphingolipids. But sphingomyelin, it's probably obvious to you that you find sphingomyelin in myelin sheaths, which are insulations that occur around certain axons in your nervous system. But that's not the only place you find them. You find sphingomyelin in run-of-the-mill cells, membranes as well. Just the membranes that occur in cells that wrap around neurons are especially rich in this stuff. All right, 14 is an example of a glycolipid. That's the fourth category that I mentioned originally. Notice that this thing is very similar to what we just looked at. Sphingosine in blue, a fatty acyl in green. The difference is what's connected at the other end. Instead of it being a phosphate, what you hook to that end place is some sort of sugar. And that's why this thing is called a glycolipid. All right, now cerebrosides, and there's more than one cerebrosides, but cerebrosides are glycolipids in which that sugar component is just a monosaccharide of some sort. So glucose or galactose, depending on which one it is, it would make a different cerebroside. But a cerebroside is a fairly simple glycolipid simply because the sugar component is only a monosaccharide. Yeah.
So that's no longer considered a phospholipid?
Right. This is a category unto itself. More complicated glycolipid would be if instead of just hooking a monosaccharide onto this overall structure, you hooked on a more complicated sugar. In that case, you would make a class of glycolipids called gangliosides, also named for their predominance in the nervous system. A ganglion is a structure in the nervous system. But anyway, cerebrosides and gangliosides and related lipids are examples of glycolipids because of that sugar component. And the fact that there are hydrophobic hydrocarbon tails on this thing means that it will easily be embedded into a membrane side by side with the phospholipids that make up most of that membrane. right? Because this part on the left is avoiding water. The sugar component doesn't mind being around water at all because of all those hydroxyls that are on the sugar. Okay, well, let's go to the fifth and final category of lipids, which are the steroids. And in slide 15, we're looking at a steroid nucleus, which means this is what all steroids have in common. There are all kinds of different steroid molecules, but all steroid molecules have this four-ring structure. And notice that three of those four rings are six-membered rings. One of them is a five-membered ring. Now, the ster part of the word steroid means solid or space, which is why stereophonic, two-channel versus monaural. Having those two channels in a sound system makes it not sound like flat, like it's coming from just a plane. It makes it sound like there's depth to the music. In other words, three-dimensionality. Well, these steroids get a similar naming because of this ring structure gives them kind of a big space to their structure. And this steroid nucleus is going to actually appear in any steroid, like I said, but hanging off of it are any of several functional groups. So it's the steroid nucleus that makes it a steroid, but what actually gives any particular steroid its individual function are the little functional groups that hang off of it here and there. That's what really makes all the difference. And so you have steroids in all groups of organisms, basically. If you think about the three groups of multicellular eukaryotes, of which we're a member of one of those groups, what are those three multicellular eukaryotes? It's a good 182 question. What are the three major taxa or groups of multicellular eukaryotes? There are some multicellular protists, but most protists are unicellular. Which three eukaryotic taxa are exclusively multicellular? And I gave you the big hint that you're a member of one of them. Animals, plants, and fungi, yes. They all have steroids for basically the same purpose. They are important membrane components as well. Steroids is not their only use. They're also really important signaling molecules like the steroid hormones. But anyway, cholesterol is the animal version of the master steroid. I call it the master steroid because if you modify cholesterol just a little bit by changing around what the functional groups are, you can make it into some other steroids that have totally different functions. Cholesterol is a really important molecule by itself because as a membrane component, it is able to buffer the fluidity of a membrane. It's able to resist drastic changes in fluidity when you change temperature, for instance, which is important because a plasma membrane can't just be a solid. It needs to be fluid. But also, cholesterol is the precursor to all the other steroids. So, for instance, you have glucocorticoids produced by your adrenal glands. Those are steroid hormones. Those come from cholesterol, just slightly modified. The estrogens, including estradiol, feminizing hormones come from cholesterol, just slightly different functional groups. Progesterone, pregnancy hormone, starts out as cholesterol. Testosterone, masculizing hormone, the androgens, comes from cholesterol. So it's the master animal steroid. Does anyone know what this word comes from? Well, sterol by itself, the ster part, of course, refers to it's a steroid. The ol means it's an alcohol, so there's an OH on it. What does coal mean? Coal is another name for bile. So this literally means bile, solid alcohol. And that's because cholesterol is a major component of bile, which is what your liver makes, right? By the way, another name for the sac that holds extra bile when it's made by the liver, which you probably know familiarly as the gallbladder. Another name for that is the cholecyst, cyst meaning bag. It's the bile bag. Anyway, that's what animals make for their steroids. There are other sterols, though, that the other two major groups make. In plants, we don't call them cholesterols. We call them phytosterols, because phyte means plant. And fungi make what we call ergosterols. Ergot is a type of fungus in which it was discovered, so that's why they're called ergosterols. But it's not just those that... Basically, any fungus has ergosterols. They're also there for a similar reason, membrane fluidity adjustment. By the way, cholesterol is also a word that always pops up in nutrition circles because we're supposed to be minimizing our intake of cholesterol because of the huge epidemic of atherosclerosis and other problems. Well, you don't take in any cholesterol if you don't eat any animals, but that doesn't mean you don't have any cholesterol in your body because you are an animal, right? If something eats you, they get cholesterol for the same reason if you eat some other animal, you get cholesterol in your diet. The reason that you make cholesterol, whether you eat it or not, is because it's absolutely essential. You don't get any of those things from it that I just talked about. So you absolutely have to have cholesterol. When it comes to its mention in nutrition, it always has a bad name. Well, it's absolutely indispensable. You just don't want to necessarily bring in a bunch of extra beyond what you're making for yourself. In slide 17, we're looking at a membrane lipid from an archaean. Remember that there are three domains to life, right? Eukarya, bacteria, and archaea. The archaeans, which is what you call a member of archaea, and it's with an O. Actually, there isn't an A in it. An archaean is a member of the domain archaea. And archaeans, just if you glance at them, don't look much different from bacteria. But they're very important differences molecularly. And in fact, archaea are more related to us eukaryotes than either of us is related to bacteria. But in terms of lifestyle, what really is definitive about archaeans is that they are extremophiles. Most of them are extremophiles. So these things live in places that would instantly kill bacteria or eukaryotes. They live at or above boiling temperature of water, for instance, or extreme acidity or extreme salinity, things that would just basically disintegrate other kinds of cells. And one of the reasons that they're able to withstand such harsh environments is because of the way their membrane lipids are constructed differently compared to bacteria and eukaryotes. You can see an example of a membrane lipid here. You still have glycerol as the keystone. That's in blue here. But instead of forming ester linkages to the fatty acyls in green, which is what you would have in a normal phospholipid like in an animal, like in you, these are not ester linkages. These are ether linkages, E-T-H-E-R. When you look at a molecule, you can see an ether group as a carbon, oxygen, carbon, COC. So these are ether linkages, and those are much more resistant to hydrolysis under these harsh environments than an ester linkage would be. In other words, the places where these things live, it would just disintegrate. It would tear off the fatty acyls from the glycerol, and they wouldn't have intact membranes and therefore wouldn't be able to live. But also there's a difference in the fatty acyls themselves. These are not normal fatty acyls. In the case of us or bacteria, those fatty acyls are unbranched hydrocarbons. Right? It's just an end-to-end carbon skeleton with some hydrogens hanging off, but no branching of carbons. Here you have some short branches along the length of each fatty acyl. And that makes them also resistant to being damaged by the harsh environment. It makes them pack even better together than you would have without the branching, and therefore makes them even less fluid than you would have if you just had a normal saturated fatty acid. And so if you're talking about something that lives at extreme temperatures, you don't have the problem of being not fluid enough, right? Everything is much more fluid when the temperature is high. So you want a more solid, less fluid membrane, which is what these little branches provide. But regardless of whether we have a lipid membrane from an archaean, a bacterium, or a eukaryote, though there are differences in how they're built, they all really have this amphipathic nature, which is why they operate as membrane lipids. So there is a polar end to the thing, and then there are two nonpolar tails to the thing. Which is why, regardless of whether we're talking about a phosphoglyceride sphingolipid or an archaean membrane lipid, we can have the same shorthand cartoon for this thing. Polar head, usually just a round ball representing the polar part, and two hydrophobic tails that are made up by the fatty acyls. Well, in the case of sphingolipids, actually just one of those is a fatty acyl, right? The rest of it is part of sphingosine itself. But in both cases, it's a hydrocarbon tail, and therefore it is hydrophobic. And finally, in 19, which is the last slide, we can see that in some cases, lipids serve as anchors to other molecules. Now, we've already talked about that in terms of glycolipids. Glycolipids are part sugar and part lipid, but the lipid component of that glycolipid anchors it in the membrane. But you can have more complex things than just a sugar hanging off of the lipid, as you see in this example. This thing on the bottom has a pretty complicated set of groups connected to this lipid tail structure that holds it in the membrane. But this thing is actually part sugar connected to the lipid and part protein. But in any case, the point is that it's the lipid that actually serves as the membrane anchor, which makes perfect sense in terms of its hydrophobicity. And so that's the end of the unit.